Good morning, Your Honor. And, Your Honor, if I could, I'm Wade McNichols. I'm here on behalf of Mr. Barker. And I would ask to reserve 3 minutes.
Three minutes? Yes, sir.
May it please the court. In 2011, the Commonwealth of Virginia adopted the Rules of Evidence. As the court's aware, that included Virginia Rule 2403. And that rule states that relevant evidence may be excluded if its probative value is outweighed by the danger of unfair prejudice or the likelihood that that evidence will confuse or mislead the jury. That is a balancing test. And the question the trial court has to weigh is, does the danger of prejudice outweigh the probative value of the evidence? In the Barker case, we'd filed a motion in limine that gave, and a stipulation, and that gave the trial court two options. One option was to deny the motion and present the jury with certified copies of two conviction and sentencing orders. Those conviction and sentencing orders carry a great deal of danger of unfair prejudice. First of all, they contain the names of the previous offenses. They contain the punishments. They contain information about the defendant's pleas to the charges. And they contain information about whether or not there have been plea agreements in those convictions. All of that information invites all sorts of undue speculation by the jury about the punishment in those earlier cases, what the reason for its harshness was or its lenity, and it also invites speculation about whether or not the defendant had struck some sort of deal for a lower punishment, whether there had been other charges that had been dismissed. Once those conviction orders get in the jury room with the punishments and with all the natures of the plea, it invites all of that.
Well, notwithstanding the balancing that suggested in the old Chief case,
yes,
under the federal system, aren't we all bound by the common law in Virginia that says that a party need not accept a stipulation, that they can put the case to the evidence? And when the rules of evidence were adopted in 2011, if I recall correctly,
yes,
common law was to be preserved. So aren't we left with that's what's going to rule here?
Your Honor, where we have the rules of evidence and the common law, while they may preserve the common law, it doesn't allow it would seem that it wouldn't allow the Commonwealth to introduce evidence in violation of the rules. And the core of this argument, of my argument, is that these conviction orders are, for want of a better term, they're basically prior bad acts evidence. And that's the reason, the real reason,
sure,
the Commonwealth is offering that evidence over and above the stipulation. It is an attempt to show the jury, or even if it's not an actual attempt, it has the effect of offering prior bad act evidence and showing the jury.
But you're essentially stipulating that if you stipulate.
You're stipulating to the defendant's status as having been convicted of a violent felony, but you're not stipulating as to
the specific
offense,
right,
or offenses. In this case, there were in this particular case, there were two conviction orders offered and submitted to the jury.
So the jury wouldn't know that your client had been convicted of essentially the same thing he was being tried for now. They just know he'd been convicted. It stipulated he was convicted of a violent felony.
With the stipulation, it would be stipulating that the defendant had previously been convicted of a violent felony. With the two conviction orders, they were I think the oldest of the two convictions was possession of a concealed weapon by a convicted felon. And the more recent conviction was for brandishing a firearm near a school. So rather than those two possibly inflammatory convictions, one of which was substantially similar to the case on trial, with those being introduced, that's a great deal of additional prejudice as opposed to just a stipulation that the defendant has the status of having been previously convicted of a violent felony.
In order for you to prevail on your argument, wouldn't we need to overrule Glover?
Your Honor, I think to some extent you might have to, and, well, the question, I don't know that you would, because Glover was decided before Old Chief and before the adoption of the rules of evidence. And so our argument, I think, in that, rather than, we're not necessarily arguing that the court should overrule Glover, we're arguing that the court should find that the rules of evidence have overruled Glover. The rules of evidence laid out a specific standard under Rule 2403 that the trial court is supposed to follow. And
except that the rules of evidence are supposed to model, as Judge Huff mentioned, the rules of evidence are supposed to model existing law. So if Glover is existing law, that, at the time that the rules of evidence are established, then Glover prevails.
Your Honor, it would simply seem that with the rules of evidence laying out this balancing test, that the Commonwealth, that the rules put some limits on what the Commonwealth can offer. And Glover had previously said that a defendant can't stipulate away the Commonwealth's case, and in most cases that would be true. However, this is a case where you have two competing proffers of evidence, I guess. You have, on the one hand, you have a stipulation, and on the other hand, you have the certified conviction orders. With the stipulation, they both, I think most of us would agree that a stipulation and a certified order are almost equal in terms of probative value. So you have equal probative value on both sides, but with the conviction orders, you have all of these dangers of unfair prejudice with all of the irrelevant and additional unnecessary information that's contained within the conviction orders.
I understand that.
Yes,
just to follow up on Judge Decker's question, that Rule 2:102 says that the rules are adopted to implement established principles under the common law and not to change any established case law rendered prior to the adoption of the rules. So that would leave Glover in place, even based on what the rules themselves say, right?
I think the court could be correct on that. And then we're left with, how does the court want to overrule Glover in light of Old Chief, which, while Old Chief is not controlling authority, certainly concede that, it deals with the federal rules of evidence, not the Virginia rules of evidence. The question we would like the court to consider is, do prejudicial impact and probative value, do those things have different meanings in Virginia courts than they do in federal courts? And we would argue that they don't. It doesn't make a lot of sense to agree with you otherwise.
I mean, the problem is, even if we were to agree with you in concept, Glover exists, and we're bound by interpanel accord doctrine to a panel decision of this court, and so we really would not be at liberty to alter that.
Except en banc.
Except en banc or above in the Supreme Court. Listen, that's the dilemma we face, even if we were to agree with you.
Certainly. I don't have an answer to that issue. It depends on how the court is going to look at the rule and the Old Chief decision and Glover. As court's aware, there is a great deal of prejudicial impact, potential prejudicial impact with these convictions. I've told the court what they were for. They were for brandishing a firearm near a school and for possessing a concealed weapon after a felony conviction. And I anticipate the Commonwealth will, in addition to arguing Glover, they'll make an argument that admitting these convictions was harmless error because of the age of the convictions. I think the most recent of them was 5 years old at the time of trial, and possessing a concealed weapon after a felony conviction, I think, was 25 years old. Mm-hmm. And while that certainly concede that one is very remote in time, we would argue that with the the brandishing a firearm near a school, at least the name of that offense is pretty, conceivably pretty frightening to potential jurors. And even with a five-year-old conviction, we would argue that that's significantly prejudicial.
Let me ask you this. On the given the facts and circumstances of the case and the curative instruction that was given, after all is said and done, isn't this at least harmless error?
Your Honor, going back to the plain language of 2403, it says that you can introduce evidence where there's a danger of prejudice. And we don't know what happened in the jury room, as the court always hears, has heard at least a couple of times since I've been sitting in here today. We don't know why juries do the things that they do. There may have been a lot of evidence, but there was a previous conviction for possessing a firearm near a school zone, and we don't know if the jury simply didn't look at that and said, this is a bad guy, we need him off the streets, we're going to find him guilty because he had this previous charge and he shouldn't even be out now. We don't know. And you don't know with the jury.
Can I ask you,
yes, sir.
In your petition for appeal, you listed two assignments of error. And it appears both were granted. Are you essentially just arguing the second one now on the motion in limine or not the motion to suppress?
Your Honor, it's my understanding that only the motion in limine was granted, but I'm not.
Yeah, that's my understanding as well. I checked and I should have talked to you.
Okay, I may be. I just was looking at the three-judge order that granted it, and so
yes,
that's
sir.
The only. That was.
And I think that was the only argument on our demand for three-judge panel.
Oh, okay. Perhaps.
And I think that may be where that is coming from. But that is the only argument we're making today. It's on the motion in limine and on the old chief issue. Now, Your Honor, the trial court had the option of accepting the stipulation, allowing and having the choice of simply instructing the jury that the defendant has been convicted of a violent felony. That has none of the dangers of prejudice that the conviction orders have. To sum up, even arguing, there's simply no other reason to introduce those conviction orders other than to show that the defendant has those prior convictions and what the convictions are. The stipulation avoids any danger of prejudice, and it tells the jury only what they need to know and nothing more. It doesn't invite any additional speculation on their part, like you conceivably have, where these conviction orders are put in evidence. And we would simply ask that the court consider finding that the trial court erred in denying the motion in limine and stipulation.
Very well, thank you. Ms. Johnson?
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Victoria Johnson and I represent the Commonwealth. This court should affirm the conviction in this case. There was no error in the trial court in admitting the sentencing orders under existing Virginia law.
Existing Virginia law, the common law that would be governing in this case, is it limited to Glover or is there something else out there that...
Well, there is Glover, and then I went through a number of cases in my brief, probably to a tedious point, and I apologize, I got going. But there are a number of cases in the Commonwealth that in different contexts apply the same principle, that the Commonwealth's evidence is not limited. There's cases, and they're in my brief, I won't bore the court with a recitation, but you know, things like pleading guilty to murder, it doesn't mean that there can't be other evidence come in at the sentencing phase to show the sentencing. There's evidence that, now my mind's going blank, but there, you know, that kind of principle that you can't sanitize the Commonwealth's evidence by stipulation and force the Commonwealth to limit its case is pretty well established in Virginia.
Well, there certainly is a prejudicial effect. The reasoning of the old Chief case, though, as a judge, the judge for whom I clerked years ago, referred to that sort of thing as the Wild Washington stuff. Is there any reason why we should not sui sponte take this en banc so that the court could consider adopting the old Chief rationale?
Well, of course, the court has the power to do that. I know that this issue has been kind of circling around for a while in Virginia courts. I would submit that this case is a poor vehicle for that, to use a Wild Washington stuff term, because there's such a strong harmless error argument in this case, and there's the limiting instruction.
Yeah.
So I have a feeling deep in my heart that eventually one of these is going to percolate up where there is no limiting instruction and we'll have kind of more of a live issue.
Well, and can we even do anything in light of Boone? I mean, it seems to me that it might be the Supreme Court's job at this point.
Well, Boone, in all candor with the court, you know, that was my case. And Boone was a little bit, the posture was a teensy bit different because the argument was relying not so much on Rule 403 as it was on the elements of the statute itself. So the argument that was put forward in the Supreme Court was that there was some kind of limitation in the elements itself. So it was a kind of a statutory construction case. That said, though, I think that Boone, even if it's not entirely on all four squares, is pretty controlling authority.
It gave approval to Glover.
It gave approval to Glover, yes, Your Honor. It gave approval to Glover and Pittman and some of the other cases that kind of circle around the same thing. So I think that given the state of the law, and kind of the posture of the case, it probably is up to the Supreme Court. You know, if the court wanted to consider it en banc and kind of, I'm not consenting to go en banc in this case, because as I said, I think that there is a problem with that. But I think that when the right case comes along, I don't think it would be inappropriate to consider it en banc and then it go to the Supreme Court, because that might help refine the issue. But I think that in this particular case, I'm going to stand on my merits argument, and rely on my brief for that. But just to go over briefly the harmless error issues, you know, as counsel conceded, one of those convictions was from 25 years ago. The 5-year-old conviction is a little more timely, but it's still, I mean, there's some temporal distance there, and the evidence in this case itself was pretty. Persuasive to the jury. It was pretty clear that this individual had a gun on his person and some more in his automobile, or perhaps his girlfriend's automobile. That was a little confusing in the record. And, you know, the limiting instruction really gave the defendant exactly what he wanted.
The juries are presumed to
follow those instructions. And we don't look behind that and try to kind of second guess that. So I would submit that, you know, no one's asked me, but I would submit the best and narrowest grounds might be a harmless error analysis in this case. The jury was instructed that, you know, that the defendant was previously convicted of these felonies is not proof that he possessed a firearm at the relevant time, and such evidence may not be considered by you in determining, you know, the facts in this case. So I don't know that you get a better limiting instruction. The jury is presumed to follow that. There's a lot of other evidence in the case. And, you know, finally, kind of, I guess, circling back to merits, even leaving Old Chief out of it, you know, Virginia law is that there's a lot of broad discretion for trial judges in hearing evidence. And, you know, the case law talks about a bell-shaped curve. You know, would no reasonable jurist ever allow these prior conviction orders in? And also, just a brief point, my understanding of Virginia law is that prior convictions must be proved, you know, in absence of a stipulation or whatnot, must be proved by certified conviction orders. So I don't think it's exactly fair to say that the Commonwealth has no other reason to put these orders in but to you know, possibly prejudice the jury unduly. That's a requirement. That's how we prove up prior convictions.
Absent a stipulation.
Right. And, you know, Glover and Pittman and the other cases and Boone all kind of stand for the proposition that if the Commonwealth doesn't want to, it doesn't have to take the stipulation.
Can't be forced.
And I think that's where we are. If the court has questions, though, I'm happy to answer them.
Well, you mentioned you thought perhaps the best and narrowest ground was harmless error. I assume you're arguing that would be non-constitutional.
Yes, Your Honor, and I addressed that in my brief. Old Chief error, and I'm not conceding error, but allegations of Old Chief error are typically, and I addressed that in the brief, are typically treated as non-constitutional. It's an analog from the federal rules of evidence, and that's not a constitutional issue. So here the standard would just be whether there's a fair, pardon me, I always get them confused and I have to write it down. Did not affect the verdict. And I think that we can say that here in light of all the evidence, in light of the limiting instruction, and in light, as I recall, the record that the defendant got the mandatory sentence. So I don't think that you can show that if there were any error, that it affected the verdict here.
Or the sentence.
Or the sentence. Because it was the mandatory sentence.
The only sentence you can be given.
Yes. It's the only sentence you can get for this crime. If there's further questions, I will be happy to address them. Other than that, I won't test the court's patience, and I'll ask that you affirm.
Thank you, Ms. Johnson. Mr. McNichols.
Your Honor, I don't know if I'll use my entire 1:51, but the only thing that I would add or rebut to counsel opposite's argument would be that regarding the Boone case, as court, and I'm sure counsel will recall, that decision has a footnote where it says, forgive me if I'm quoting, if I'm misquoting, we expressly decline to consider whether the Old Chief case applies. Just ask the court to take that into account in considering this case, and would ask the court to find that there was error.
Very well. Thank you. We'll step down and greet.